You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Sleeping Giants in the Daylight. Elaine Panopoulos was woefully inadequate. This was documented fact. In college, a professor had written it in red capital letters across the top of her final paper, woefully inadequate. In the coloring of years, it had amplified, and now Elaine took it to apply to her whole life. In fact, the professor had written, "Your footnotes are woefully inadequate," in simple black ink at the end. But what did that matter now?
The new collection of linked short stories by Elizabeth Stix is Things I Want Back From You. Thank you for joining me, Elizabeth.
I am delighted to talk with you today.
This is a wonderful story and book. All the stories were wonderful. And one of the things that it made me think about was back in the 1930s, in the science fiction genre, there was a tradition called the fix-up novel. Mm. And the fix-up novel was responsible for some of the, you know, barn burner founding works of science fiction. In fact, the foundation books were fix-up novels, wherein the authors wrote some short stories that were vaguely connected and then said, hey, I'm going to make a novel out of this. And they just strung them together. And that's why the foundation novels are, well, they're foundational science fiction. They're not great novels. This, on the other hand, is the collection of stories. It's really wonderful in the kind of links. I would suggest it lives beyond the, it's more than a collection of linked stories. I'd say it gets close to the idea of a mosaic novel. And mm-hmm.
That's a good way to put it.
I was wondering if you would talk about the creating these stories and just creating the background, Sand and Encanto. What a great name for a suburb of San Francisco.
Well, I wrote the book over a really long period of time. And it started out as they're all standalone stories now. And they started out being written as standalone. And then I realized they could be a collection, but it wasn't a linked collection. And as I was putting it together, I realized that these characters seem to be the same characters at different stages of their lives. It seemed to be moving through time. And that's when I realized that I could just change things around and make it have some continuity and some arcs. And once I did that, I filled in. I realized there were some gaps and some characters whose arcs needed completing, and some questions that posed that I needed to answer. So then I wrote some new stories to make the whole book have a shape, not just each story. So the stories are linked. They all live at the same at the end of the same cul-de-sac in this fictional town called San Encanto, and they enter and re-enter each other's stories and each other's lives over a period of about 50 years, having different interpersonal dynamics, family secrets sort of created and discovered and fallout from that. I had thought about marketing it as a novel in stories, because I don't know if you've ever tried to sell a book, but everybody wants a novel. Not as many publishers want short stories. And I thought, could this be a novel in stories? And I tried it and I thought, you know, it really isn't. It really is a short story collection. It is a very deeply linked, layered, and I love how you just put that, a mosaic of a short story collection. It has a shape. The book has a shape as a whole, but it's not quite a novel. You know, Jennifer Egan has the very famous book, A Visit from the Goon Squad. That's also a collection. And that is not marketed as short stories or a novel. That is just marketed as fiction. If you look at that book, it's just called fiction. So, actually, now I'm not sure, that one might be a novel, but it was hard to find the right sweet spot for it.
Talk about just finding the voice for all of these stories, because you have a really delightful voice that's at once funny and kind of sweet, but also dark and, you know, at times alarmingly frank.
I don't know exactly. Finding the voice is, in a way, the easiest part, because it's the most intuitive part. Finding plot is harder for me than finding voice. I do think that life is really funny, and I think that life is really sad, and I think that life is really hard and really also sort of wondrous. So I do think that all of those things are encompassed in the human experience. So it's fun to include them. I think it's just the way I view the world.
It's very entertaining. You know, one of the things that struck me about this book was that the more I read it and got into the stories, you know, every time I'd start a story, I kind of feel afraid for the characters, that things were going to turn out not well, or, you know, and not like they'd die or anything, but just, you know, they'd have some horrific embarrassment. And I can tell you, I'm a person, I would rather be eaten by jaws or snapped up by the alien than to suffer a terribly embarrassing experience in front of a large crowd, or even a small crowd, or even one person. So as I read these stories, they're charming, they're delightful, they're realistic, they're surrealistic. I kind of kept having this feeling of dread. And to a certain extent, especially given the turns of some of the stories, I kind of felt this was almost like, you know, a reinvention of the horror genre. There used to be, you know, there was splatterpunk, and then there was what was called quiet horror. This is back in the 80s. And this could easily be, you know, you could have easily sold this as a collection of quiet horror stories back in the 80s.
I don't think they're that scary. I don't know. No, you're the first person who said horror. I have had people assign it different genres, like magic realism, which I actually don't think it is. But about the, like, sort of the cringe moment for the characters, I do really enjoy weak, flawed, self-sabotaging heroes who are their own worst enemy and who get in their own way, because I actually think that's fairly realistic. Like you said, it resonated so much with you that you'd rather die than experience it, you know, you must be eaten by sharks. I think that what interests me, so to me, the book is all about people in their desperately human search for connection with others. And they're always so close. They're so close to it, and it's just out of reach. And the reason that it's out of reach is usually because they have fear and insecurity and very human frailties that just trip them up. And I find that very poignant. And there is a sort of exquisite pain in that, and in that what you desire is at hand. Just grab it. And they just usually can't, even though they actually could. So I find that a very poignant thing to explore. The tension around the inability to, you know, permit the vulnerability that is being human. But in the story, I do think they end on a hopeful note. I do think that I do think that these characters keep on going. They glimpse connection. They glimpse these tiny victories, and some of them do attain it, sometimes fleetingly. But I kind of think that can reflect a certain kind of humanity. And I feel a lot of compassion for these characters. I wouldn't say they live horrible lives. I mean, as in horror, as in lives of horror.
And no, but I really like your description there. And this gets to, I think, an element that I think you do really, really well. These stories are all very realistic. And I don't mean in that they're super gritty stories of the street and all this kind of stuff. They're kind of like everyday life in the suburbs brought to a charming life and seen with a kind of intelligence that one is unlikely to experience when one is immersed in the events themselves. One of the things I think you do really well with these kind of small-scale stories is invest them with a really intense kind of tension. So talk about building tension, because you suggested that you had difficulties with plot. I would say your work with plot is masterful, because you managed to keep us in this grip of, you know, terror and enjoyment and humor, while, you know, in a sense, you know, very little is happening. You know, they're going to the store, they're at work, you know, she's gal's working at the your storage unit company.
Right.
So talk about creating that kind of tension.
So one of the reasons that I'm drawn to short stories as opposed to novels as a writer is because I believe that the human experience is lived in moments. It's not lived in eras or years. What happens to you that is the most intense and interesting and exciting and visceral is a beat of your life, is a moment. Right? Like when you're remembering a relationship, you're not going to remember the entirety of it. You're going to remember, you know, the last glance you gave to your mother before she died, for example. I think a moment can contain the entirety and intensity of a whole relationship. And those are the most interesting moments and beats to explore. So I think that that's why a person can have an experience in a grocery store that is life-changing. That actually happens at the end of Resurrection Man. In a grocery store, there's a very small exchange between a man and his girlfriend. And he realizes she's cheating on him. Everything he thought before was not true. Everything is going to be over. Everything's going to be different. And it has all these resonances. And it's just a moment. And I find that moment more interesting to sit with than sort of tracking their relationship over decades.
You know, one of the things that I think you do really well in this book is to use different kind of prose structures. Now, I love the first story, the Immortal Essential List. Talk about creating a story with lots of tension, lots of insight into a relationship that's just a list.
Well, another thing that I love about the short story form is that it's really welcoming to experimentation with form. Like, for example, the first story is a numbered breakup letter, things I want back from you. It starts out with a list of things she wants back from her ex-boyfriend, becoming increasingly unhinged and intangible. In fact, each section of the book, there are three sections of the book, and each section begins with a letter from this recurring character, Spirit Rosenblatt, life coach. The first one is a breakup letter. The second one is a house sit note as she's about to go off to a life coaching conference. And then the third letter from her is her evaluation form that she hands in after exiting the life coaching conference. But I have other stories that are also play with form. And I think that, you know, you can get away with something for 10 pages that you cannot get away with for 300. You know, like the story, The Acorn, where, you know, spoiler alert, the protagonist's mother dies and is reincarnated as a talking mole on his shoulder. And he has to figure out what he wants to do with his mother. And, you know, that you can sustain that for 15 pages, but I don't know that you could sustain that for 300 pages, you know? So I like to play, fiction is, the reason I love fiction is because you really can make things up. You can make anything up that you want. And sometimes people forget that and they stick to things that are really literal. And I like being able to just remember that when you're making stuff up, you can make up anything you want. So I think short fiction is really, really a good playground for that.
The story with the gentleman who ends up with a mole with his mother on his back, it is a wonderful story, and it's an interesting thing you do by doing that. It's you externalize the mother and allow the reader to do your externalization, to have the characters in the plot turn and have conversations that would otherwise be impossible, and give insights that would just be also impossible. And I will say that when I was but a lad, I bought a book, Scholastic Collection of Short Horror Stories. It was an incredibly good collection with some really great work in there. And one of them was by Robert Bloch, who best known for writing A Psycho and writing about the life of Ed Gein. And he had a short story in there called The Mannequin, about a man who has a half-formed brother on his back that talks to him. And I thought, wow, this really is, you know, it takes the horror genre in a sense and turns it on its side and makes it funny and insightful. And you know, not it's still terrifying, but what's terrifying is not so much the fact that he has a talking mole on his back, but the fact that he and his mother have a deeply mentally ill relationship.
It's so interesting that you call this horror. I had this book appeared on a list of like best science fiction.
Oh, really?
Of the summer, and now you're saying it's great horror, and I had to convince the publicist not to list it as magic realism. And a lot of the stories are just very grounded in realism. And I actually think it's, I once described it as, because it's a linked stories, I described it as it's like Olive Kitteridge, but with more suburban angst. You know, they're all set in the suburbs and it's very angsty. I really actually like that people are finding different resonances within it.
That's the hallmark of good fiction. Every short story is a mirror for people's.
Yeah, I love that. I really love that. You asked me, what was your question about?
Well, I suppose, I can't remember, so let me go on to this one. This is, as you mentioned, this is an interesting book about the suburbs, and that's you know, much of America lives in a suburb and lives a suburban life, you know, but there's just a brick worth of fiction that covers the suburbs and in any depth whatsoever. And I might say that that's actually, I think, one of the strengths of Stephen King. Mm-hmm. He's one of the few guys who seems to know what it's like to live up in a tract house. So talk about, you know, choosing to set your work in the suburbs. Did you find it confining to do so?
Well, first of all, I think that a confined space in fiction is a good thing because it increases pressure. I think that a book that has parameters, physical parameters, some kind of claustrophobia forces stuff to happen. The smaller space you're in, the higher the tension and more something has to happen. So I do like that they're all at the end of the same cul-de-sac. They're all mixing up and they all maybe are getting too close in some ways. And then when there's fallout, they're still stuck with each other. So you have to live with the consequences. So I do like any confined space in a story, but the suburbs attracted me because they have this benign presentation. They're like the epitome of bland. The houses tend to look alike. They're well kept up. They're sort of like the epitome of the word facade. You know, they have the same driveways and the same cars in the driveways, but yet they don't touch. The houses don't touch. So you don't necessarily know what's going on in the neighbor's house. It's not like you can hear them through the ceiling. So there's a certain amount of, I don't know, it was ripe for that intermixing, but it was also ripe for exploring family secrets and what goes on behind closed doors, what goes on behind facades, and how these seemingly benign settings can contain, you know, really sort of spicy, complicated dynamics that can, you know, pass on through generations.
One of the things I thought was really fun about this book was you have a great sense of humor. It is hilarious.
Thank you.
Was that easy?
You know, it usually is. It's funny because when I was starting out writing, I would write a serious story and I would write a funny story and I would write a funny story and it would come out much faster. And I would labor and labor and labor over the more serious story. My mother always told me that I should write more funny stories. And I always rejected it because I thought that wasn't really, really legitimate. If it came easily and it was funny, it wasn't like literature. And, you know, you kind of want to like prove your chops and prove that you're good. So I would write these dead serious stories. And I don't think ultimately they were as original, and I don't think they were as good. And so once I just gave myself permission to write a funny story and allow myself to believe that a funny story can contain multitudes and can contain depth and pathos and all the other stuff that you can find in a dead serious story, I think they're more fun to write and they're more fun to read.
Well, there are moments in this book that are simultaneously dead serious and kind of heart-shattering on one hand, but laugh out loud funny at others. And I'm thinking of the denouement of a story that begins at a New Year's Eve party.
Yes, I thought you might be talking about that.
That was like a really brilliant moment. And one of the things I think each of these stories does very well is to orchestrate. I mean, they're just really beautifully like little tinkery, perfect machines that you'd see like in a Terry Gilliam movie or something crawling across the table and all of a sudden they open up and pop out and you go, oh my God, that is grotesque and hilarious at the same time.
Well, it's a wonderful thing to say.
So talk about orchestrating, you know, that kind of, and carrying with you throughout the book, you seem to have a dual vision of things as beautiful and tragic and loving and filled with compassion and potential and always falling short.
Yeah, I think there is a little bit of grossness. Like sometimes, like there's a worm, you know.
We'll talk about that because
there's some things that are a little gross, and that's also part of life. I don't know. I think that when you write about something with humor, it brings the audience along with you in a way. They're along for the ride. They let their guard down. They loosen up. And then when you're going to maybe surprise them, maybe ambush them or sort of startle them with something that's, well, more startling, more serious, more gross, I think that they might be more receptive to it because they're sort of just hanging loose and laughing. So I think that it's like maybe the honey with the medicine, you know, it's a way to have access to your reader's open mind so that you can talk about more deep things.
Limber them up with laughter and then deliver the pointy message.
Stick them with a knife.
You know, one thing that you did over the entirety of the book, all of these people have jobs and we see them at their jobs, and it's a variety of jobs, but a very certain variety of jobs. It is a suburban variety of jobs. Some of these people work at shops, as attendants at shops, or in small offices. And I think you have a wonderful vision of that. That's, you know, again, a little bit chilling in the Kafkaesque moment. And there's a really great part where somebody is giving a lecture, you know. Here we go. Where you write, now that he's the manager, it's like he's Dana Carvey. Drafts of motivational posters from our animal collection are pinned on the wall. One has two alligators creeping out of a moat, grinning while the man's leg walks out of the frame. The word teamwork is below in ornate cursive. I have seen those posters and also the counterpoint posters called demotivators.
So there are doodles in the book, and that poster is the last image in the book, the alligators, the teamwork poster.
Well, did you do the doodles?
My husband, Jeffrey Fryman, did the doodles.
Wow. Well, there we go. A man of many talents.
Many talents, yes.
Talk about, you know, getting an understanding of, you know, the import of employment in our lives, because we all depend on our jobs, but it's hard to take, you know, the mostly stupid jobs most of us have particularly seriously, at least seriously enough to keep them. So talk about, you know, that kind of your vision of employment in the suburbs.
Well, the passage that you read from is from a guy who works at a company that makes inspirational posters. And the company's called Inspirvation with an exclamation point at the end. And because these stories are linked, several characters actually work at Inspirvation over time. And if you're looking for Easter eggs, posters from Inspirvation show up in different settings. There's a story, What's Left at the End, in the hospital. And those posters are on the wall in the hospital. So this is actually a book with lots of Easter eggs that you're not expected to, I don't expect the reader to notice them all. But I think maybe part of that came from my own history working at a menial jobs growing up and working as a temp. I think working as a temp is like a fantastic window to the world, seeing all the different people that you might not cross paths with normally and forming relationships with people because they're on the other side of the cubicle. And, you know, needing the job, but also hating the job. So there are a lot of, and there's just a lot of dead time too in some of these jobs, just dead time to sit and think. In the story Safekeeping, where the girl works at a storage facility, at one point there's a dead period of time. And so she takes out a piece of paper and she makes a pro-con list. She writes pro on one side of the paper and con on the other side of the paper. And she draws a line down the middle and she can't think of anything to put on either side. So she just throws the paper away. So there's just a universes of existential angst that you can just explore from sitting in a cubicle, I think. There's romances that bloom in the second story. Actually, in The Acorn, they start out working, you know, visiting each other in the cubicle, and they're sabotaged by the, you know, janitor who drives the very loud vacuum past them. So, I mean, I've worked in my share of cubicles.
As have I. You know, also, too, I really loved it. As I read the story and started noticing how interlinked it was really fun to put that together, kind of like a mind-blowing in a sense where you're going, wait, that person is turned up here and these people are turned up there. And in particular, the two kids who start out early on doing magic and end up growing up. And I love that not only do you manage to connect people that are in the same time, you track them across time. And we see these two boys grow up and mature. That's really tricky. Talk about how much of this stuff did you have to retcon in and go back, okay, now wait, they're here and this here. Is there like a giant wall you have with all sorts of pieces of yarn connected to it?
I did have post-it notes on the wall and some charts on my computer to track, because I wrote a lot of the stories and I would have to fix things so that, like, if somebody's 10 in this story and they're 40 in that story and they're watching the news when they're 40, like, who's the newscaster? So I would have to, like, make sure, like, there's one story where the parents initially meet in the 70s when Skylab falls. So who's going to be, they see that on the news, who's going to be the newscaster delivering that news, you know? And then later he's watching news about Clinton's impeachment. So how old does everybody else have to be? And what else? So I had to orient the world to match the timeline as the characters aged through time.
Well, you do a masterful job. And that's an interesting, you know, when we talk about storytelling, each story has its own little story wheels that go. But as we read the whole book, there's a feeling, a wonderful feeling, that it's all kind of, you know, it's like a novel in the background that's happening.
I like that.
And so it's a very interesting thing to attempt. Talk about doing that. I mean, you suggested, and I've heard many a tale of, you know, the difficulty of selling short story collections. This really does, I think, cross the line into novelistic territory, in that we do get to see characters change over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love how you call it a short story collection with a novel in the background. I like that. You know, I could have made it a novel. I could have made it a novel, and I could have made it a novel in stories. And ultimately, I chose not to. Ultimately, I thought, I'm a short story writer. I love short stories, and it is what it is. And so hopefully people will enjoy reading them as short stories. And they do, you know, I participated in a luncheon where the guest of honor was Joyce Carol Oates, and she's an incredibly generous person with her thoughts and her feedback. And she was asking me about my book, and I told her, I described it, and I said it was like, I described it as people moving through time and the way people move through time, because it takes place over about 50 years. And I described it to her. When I was done, she said, well, it sounds to me like it's a book about the way that time moves through people. And I thought that was such a beautiful way to put it. I thought that was much more accurate. Like maybe we're not these fixed objects that move through time, but maybe we are these fluid, changeable beings, and time moves through us, and we are different people at the end than we were in the beginning. And so that gave it a lot more breathing room in life to think about the passage of time over 50 years being a book about how time moves through people.
You know, it's interesting because now that you pointed out, yeah, 50 years is about right. That's a long time to cover in a really, I mean, you want to say
book.
This novel set over 50 years. Somebody's going, oh my God, it's 800 pages.
No, it's not even 200 pages.
That's what's really wonderful about it. So talk about, you know, did you think in terms of that span of time when you wrote the stories and decided to connect them? Or was there a time when they were all set in the present day in which they were written?
Like I said, these stories were written over a really long period of time, and they weren't written linearly. They weren't written chronologically. Like the last story in the book, when the patriarch of the novel is at his oldest, that wasn't the last story I wrote. The last story I wrote was the one that's pretty much in the middle, Party at the End of the World, that you mentioned. And I wrote that story because I had basically written the whole arc of the book, but I wanted a story where all the characters were together in the same story, because I didn't have that yet. I had them all crossing into each other's stories, but I didn't have this anchor story where they were all together. And I didn't have a story where, I had a story where the parents were married, and I had a story where the parents were no longer married, but I didn't have the moment of separation. And I thought that that needed to happen on the page. So I wrote that story because I wanted a story where the parents came apart, and then we also just saw everyone together. So it needed to be a party, right? So that everyone's together. So that's why it's the New Year's Eve party, and they all gather, and everything happens that happens there, and everything sort of implodes and explodes. And then the third section of the book is sort of the fallout or the aftermath of that. So, you know, I just wrote it. I did fill in gaps as I saw them after. And I did a lot of adjusting of the time once I realized, once I realized how it was the general flow, where there were still characters that I was interested in. There's a story called Five Kinds of Disaster, where it's a numbered list, and you sort of revisit five characters who you've seen before. Some of them are secondary characters, but you still want to know what happened to them. So there's just this, there's one that's got some backstory explaining why one of them has scars, and there's just a couple of people where you find out how they ended up. And so I did some, you know, bow tying that when I found loose ends.
One of the things that gives this book a really interesting feel, because on one hand, as you suggest, it is a collection of stories, and any, you can pick it up and read it, any story, and they're fun and funny and sweet and insightful and slightly weird. But as you read the stories in the order they are given, you get a lot more information about all of the characters, and it becomes really fun to, you know, try to capture and remember all the Easter eggs.
Right.
Now, having done this and had this completed, talk about, you know, your publishing process, particularly Black Lawrence Press, which is an interesting press, and readers who want to read the book immediately, and they should, can just go to Black Lawrence Press and order it. It's run by Diane Gettle. So tell us about her and the influence she had on the book.
Well, so a lot of the stories in the book were first have been published in magazines and journals. There's 21 stories in the book, and at least half of them have been published as standalone. And then when it became a collection, I sent it around to agents, and I did get the agent that I wanted. I got my what I thought was a dream match, a man named Henry Dunow in New York. And he liked it, and he believed in it, and he called it a little gem of a book. And he gave me some advice and tightened it up. And he sent it out to, I think, like 14 big houses. And they all said very nice things, very, very nice things. And they said no. Some of them said, is she working on a novel? And I wasn't. And then we didn't give up. We sent it to sort of one might call medium-sized publishers. Still seems big to me, but medium-sized publishers. And they also said no. And the funny thing was, I had sent this to Diane Gettle at Black Lawrence Press like 6 months before. I sent it to her before I had an agent. And the day after I signed with my agent, she called me very excited and said she wanted to publish the book. And I was dumbstruck. And I said, you know, I just signed with an agent yesterday, and I think I want to give it a try. I want to give an agent a try. So she said, you should do that. If it doesn't work out, you know, call me back. So we tried all these big houses for like about a year, and I added stories and I fixed it up. And after about a year had passed and it hadn't gone to the big houses, I contacted Diane Gettle and I said, hey, remember how like a year ago you said that if it didn't work out with the big houses, you might want to publish my book? And she read it again and she said she would be delighted to publish it. So that's how I ended up at a small independent press after doing the whole circuit with the big guys. So my experience with her has been super, you know, to have that direct contact with the boss, you know, to be able to ask questions and have the person who knows the answers answer them, to be able to give input onto the cover and, you know, not be just a cog in a machine, has been really nice. We did have a little snafu because, you know, she was distributed by a small press distribution, which closed their doors suddenly at a very inopportune time and left a lot of small publishers high and dry with a lot of their inventory, a lot of their money. And so there was a lot of scrambling, and Diane was very deftly able to get a new publisher, a new distributor in IPG. So we do have a new distributor, and we're just migrating all the metadata now to the new distributor. So it should be available on Amazon and bookshop.org and Books A Million and orderable from your favorite independent bookstore. any day. But if it is still hard to find this week or in the coming days, the book is available now on the Black Lawrence Press website, blacklawrencepress.com, or the IPG website, or I think you can request it from your local independent bookstore. And I think they can get it. They can order it now from IPG. But it has been a little bit of a rocky couple of weeks. But overall, Black Lawrence Press is a very, very professionally run shop. And it was a pleasure to work with them.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about the layers of publishers. The publishing landscape has changed greatly in my years as a author, interview, a podcaster. Mm-hmm. And this also happened, it changed for you when you were in the mid writing your story. So how much of an effect did that change have on you as a writer in terms of, you know, like, did you find yourself thinking, God, maybe I'm just writing for me, and, you know, if I get the story done and I like it, well, good enough.
I always thought that, and I still think that, actually. I feel like writing is such a crapshoot. It is kind of like buying a lottery ticket and being sad and full of self-loathing if it's not the lottery ticket that wins. I feel like you have to write for the daily experience of writing. The joy and the satisfaction and the success and the end and the reason that you write, it has to be because you enjoy your daily experience, because you only have your daily experience. This book took me, like, honestly, almost 20 years to write. The first story was published in 2004. And so, yeah, I'm having some bumps in the road now. But even if I wasn't, even if it was a completely smooth sail and it was having incredible, you know, Reese's Book Club or whatever, if I had a lousy 20 years, nothing can be worth that. Nothing can make up for that. No moment of publication can make up for your life if you didn't enjoy your life while you were writing it. So I wrote the book and tried to enjoy writing the book as much as I could, and I did. And when I was done, like, that was the victory. I really believe that. I really felt like I did it. And every single thing that happens after this point is icing. And it has been. And I think, you know, it's made it a lot. I maybe because I'm older, maybe because it took me so long, because when I was younger, I wanted more than icing, you know? But you have to make your life's path. This is part of it. It's not it.
That is some inspiring words, young lady. Are you working on something new now?
Well, there's a character in the book named Spirit Rosenblatt. She's the one who writes the letters. She's a very earnest life coach. And I did start a novel, a mystery. It was a cozy mystery. And then I thought, maybe it's not even a cozy mystery at all. Maybe it's just a book with a murder. But Spirit is thrown into this situation where she needs to solve a murder. And I have it all planned out, outlined more deeply than I've ever outlined anything. But then I had to stop to promote and publicize and work on the birth of this book. So I haven't touched it for about 6 months, this novel. And working on this Things I Want Back From You kind of got me excited about short stories again. So right now I don't know if I'm going to go back and finish the novel or if I'm going to continue writing short stories. I really don't.
You know, one of the things that interested me about this book was the location and the mapping. Talk about the import of this being, you know, this is a left coast book.
Right. So the map, you mean literally the map that's on the front of the book?
Yeah.
Just the location of the San Encanto.
And also, I'm guessing Jeffrey's map at the somewhere in there, or the,
right.
of the cul-de-sac.
So Jeff drew the town of San Encanto, and that wasn't there at first. That, I think, was my agent's suggestion, because there are a lot of characters in this book, and you really need to be oriented to where they are. It really helps ground you to be like, okay, he's up the street, he's down the street, this is where they are, this is where supervision is, this is where the storage facility is, just to sort of see a little cartoony map of the town. I do think that helps orient you when the stories, I mean, like they span 50 years and there's a whole bunch of different characters. So I think the map helped. I did grow up in Marin. I grew up in Mill Valley. And so in my mind's eye, that suburb is somewhere past Fairfax, somewhere around San Geronimo in those woodsy corners. And I wanted it to be a fictional suburb as opposed to a real suburb, because the laws of the universe of that town are different than the laws of the universe of any real town, because sometimes magic can happen in them. Some of the stories are grounded in realism, and then sometimes something magical happens, you know, like an oppressive husband in one story turns into a dirigible. And he flies over his wife and he shadows her, and he sometimes tumbles down from the sky and squashes her on the sidewalk. So I needed to invent a town where the laws of that town could encompass both magic and realism. So I made up the town of San Encanto.
And finally, one thing I wanted to ask you about is that there are lots of animals in this book,
yes.
pets. And I love the way you use pets. A, it helps us kind of, there are another connection between the stories, but also pets are a great way of externalizing a character who owns them or who keeps them, depending on how you perceive such things.
Well, I think that a lot of these people are searching for comfort and connection. And I think that sometimes it's easier to find that with a pet than with another person. So I think sometimes pets are sort of the holders of all the love these people want to give. I also think that relationships between pets are totally legit and completely profound and deep and complex. And I do think that pets can play an important role in a person's life, especially in a lonely person's life. So I think that they have their place there, a very important place as characters.
As the keeper of two pugs, I will certainly agree with you.
Right.
I've been speaking with Elizabeth Stix. Her new collection of linked short stories is Things I Want Back From You. Thank you for joining me, Elizabeth.
It has been such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.